The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and major public research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries at UWM today. Here's the host of UWM Today, Tom Lujak, Vice Chancellor for University Relations and Communications.
As we continue to see development occur, both in our country and other lands, the need for ensuring that it be sustainable has never been greater. Increasing populations and often shrinking resources pose immense challenges to our society. On this edition of UWM Today, we're going to take a deeper look at the difficulties presented by the continued expansion of our communities and the impact that growth is having on the environment. Joining us in the studio is Tim Haas. Tim is an associate professor of business statistics at the Lubar School of Business at UWM. Welcome, Tim. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
So you are a specialist in statistics, and you're interested in sustainability. Tell us what that connection is. How did you become interested in sustainability?
I've always been interested in how humans make decisions, and my PhD in statistics was focused on modeling John F. Kennedy's XCOM, the subcommittee that he convened to handle the Cuban Missile Crisis. So I've built models of how groups of individuals reach a decision. As I moved through my career, I started to think about what was possibly the number one problem facing the planet. And I saw loss of biodiversity as something that you really can't recover from. You can recover from many other environmental disasters, but once you lose a species, there's essentially no hope of bringing it back. So unlike global warming, where there's a number of things that you can do to mitigate the downside, once you lose a large number of species, you have severely damaged the planet, and you really can't fix it. So I thought, well, let's see if we can look into how one could manage an ecosystem wherein everybody gets as close to what they want as possible.
And looking for that sweet spot of compromise, huh?
Yes, yes. And the idea was to build a decentralized, agent-based model of how people really do manage a big ecosystem like, say, Kruger National Park in South Africa. You'd like to think it's command and control, but in fact you have poor people living close to the park, and they poach resources of the park in order to add to their incomes. Well, this poaching puts wildlife populations at threat. You can't shoot all the poachers. You have to start asking yourself, how can we come up with a way of governing ourselves such that the animal populations are not driven to extinction in our efforts to get what we want, have a livelihood. So I've been looking at models of how individuals reach local decisions that maximize their own goals and how a government can find a way to dovetail into what people are naturally wanting to do with regulations and carrots and sticks to get them to harm the populations around them, the wildlife populations around them, as little as possible so that those populations survive. So what I've brought to the table in my first book with Wiley was to integrate ecological models with political models, because the ecology impacts the politics and the politics impacts the ecology.
So you've got what essentially is a social or political problem, in this case, in a country in Africa where you, as you point out, have the poor and the protected. Maybe that's a good way to position these two pieces. And you're actually using your training in statistics to try to find that compromise using politics and social sciences.
Yes. I consider myself more a mathematical modeler that uses statistics to validate the model and make it believable.
So give us an example of how you would use statistics in that very scenario that you painted.
Well, you build what are called belief network models of how people reach a maximum personal utility decision. So that's a probability model. Then you observe the behavior of this group of people over some length of time, and you observe under what conditions they choose what output decision. You then take this data set that you've acquired on their behavior, and you use a statistical algorithm to fit the parameters of the decision-making model. Now someone comes up to you who is critical of what you're doing and says, well, your model, it's like these global warming models. Anybody can build a mathematical model. And your answer is, well, no, this model has been tested against data, and it does a very good job of replicating the data. That's what statisticians do. They don't just build a model. They fit the model to actual observations in the real world. So I've used my statistical training and my engineering training to build models of how humans make decisions. I've also looked into the ecology literature and found models of wildlife populations and how they're impacted by what is euphemistically called harvesting.
So at the root of this, though, is making sure that you gather good data at the front end. Talk about that process, especially when you're dealing, as you pointed out, with some very poor people, some belonging to tribes.
Well, I just came back from Kruger National Park in South Africa a few days ago. While down there, I worked with the detectives working for South African National Parks to acquire information on the criminal network involved in rhino horn poaching. So I spent much time working with the detectives who were gathering informant and cell phone transmission data to find out who was talking to who and who was paying for the poaching raids. This data is invaluable because I have a large social network model of how these individuals organize themselves to decide when they should go out on a raid, and I needed data on the number of individuals, who was more central than who else, who were the soldiers and who were the leaders. So Sandparks helped me acquire the social network data, and I'm now hard at work fitting my social network model to this data. They will then use my results to identify the top criminals and go out and find them and arrest them and take them out of the network, much like trying to disrupt a terrorist network.
So instead of going after every single one of those poachers, the idea is to decapitate the big players at
yes,
the top.
Yes, yes. The CIA calls it rolling up a network.
Wow. How long has this type of modeling been around in these sorts of situations?
Well, social networks and agent-based models in general have only been around for probably mainstream about 15 years, because before that we didn't have the computing power to have any hope of fitting the parameters of models that would take minutes to hours to run just once. But since computers have become extremely fast, we're now able to model the decision-making of down to groups of five and in some cases actual individuals and how they interact with each other. We also do this with animals. So there are large models now that are replacing the classic differential equation models of how wildlife populations grow and shrink by modeling every individual rhinoceros or every individual African buffalo and then building a model of how they interact with their fellows and how they interact with the environment in the form of what they can eat and who's out to kill them.
So you must be using technology extensively to be able to do that kind of tracking.
I can't get enough computing power. And if there's something that I need the most, and I can speak for many young researchers at every university in the world, it's we all need 100 times more computing power, and we need it yesterday.
Wow. So are others around the world doing the same sort of statistical modeling in the fashion that you are?
It is not widely done because the ecologists are afraid of dipping into social science, and the social scientists know nothing about ecology. So this is an interdisciplinary research effort just along the lines of our new building at UWM, the Center for Interdisciplinary Research.
Right, going up on the corner of Kenwood and Maryland, finally a crane on the UWM campus, right?
Exactly, yes.
Big $80 million research building that will be opening in about a year and a half or so. And so you'll be doing some of your work out of that facility.
Well, I'm going to be probably going over there and trying to beg them for computer time.
How did you get interested in this really, really intriguing mix of ecological studies and statistics?
Well, when I was a graduate student pursuing my PhD in statistics at Colorado State University, I worked for the Natural Resource Ecology Laboratory. And they were doing an awful lot of modeling of plant and animal populations. I started writing statistical programs for them, and I slowly got to know a number of ecologists there. Well, that dovetailing into my work on political decision-making, once I earned tenure, I decided let's make a concentrated effort to try to integrate these two fields, because that's how the world really works. The world is not partitioned into academic disciplines. The world's integrated. So we need integrated research. The problem is most journals have a lot of suspicion when they see an interdisciplinary paper across their desk.
Because it's not pure.
Yes, and there's a lot of prejudice. Young researchers that are not tenured take a big chance in working in an area that is interdisciplinary because their rejection rate may be higher than they can afford to earn tenure. But post-tenure, you can afford more to take a bunch of hits and keep going in the direction of interdisciplinary work. And I think Lovell's focus on an interdisciplinary research building is extremely edgy. There is a big chance. But I see a lot of leadership wherein he says, obviously, he's putting his money where his mouth is.
This is Chancellor Mike Lovell at the UWM campus.
That he is saying we need interdisciplinary work and we need to support it.
Tim, who's funding the work that you're doing, for example, in the African preserves?
Sandparks gives me a place to sleep, and they have opened their houses to me as their internet goes down in their main facilities. I drive over to my host scientist's house, and I use his internet. However, at the moment, we are looking for funding from World Wildlife Fund to continue my plane tickets down there. But this is all up at the moment up in the air.
Wow. Well, but it sounds like nobody else is doing this right now.
Oh, they were extremely ecstatic when I was able to build analyze a 147-person network 2 weeks ago. Well, actually a week ago. They were just ecstatic because they found that I had discovered individuals that were actually information brokers that they should go after. So the problem is when you look at what needs to be done in the world and what you can get funding for, there's not a lot of overlap sometimes.
And thus the search begins on your part for the funding stream to do some of this cutting-edge research.
We have 6 years at the present poaching rates before we lose the rhino population in Kruger. I would love to sit back and write proposals, but there's no time. I'm doing the work now. And you can say that for hundreds of species in the world. There is no time. Work needs to be done on these problems immediately. It is in a sense, a state of crisis.
You're teaching in the Lubar School of Business. It's not letters in science. It's not anthropology. Your focus or your home is in a place that ostensibly is interested in creating capitalist enterprises that make money, employ people, create jobs. How were you able to carve out this niche looking at sustainability of biodiversity in a business school?
I was hired because of my interest in management and management decision-making, which was in part the focus of my dissertation. Once I got there, I published a number of papers in Straight Statistics and established my credibility. But yes, in years past, business schools didn't see sustainability as part of their charter. That has changed in about the past 7 years. Now corporations, many, are publishing every year what is called a corporate sustainability report. They are seeing that their shareholders and their customers want to know what they are doing to help the planet because they obviously have tremendous resources. Because of that, my efforts, which were being unnoticed and essentially just grudgingly tolerated, are increasingly being viewed as relevant, which I welcome. I am quite pleased with that. I was asked by the Center for International Education 2 years ago to teach a course on environmental policy, which I just finished last semester. And I had all business students in the course. And I talked about what corporations can do actively to help the environment instead of constantly feeling like they're being put upon by governments and being passive. My main point in that course was that corporations, instead of complaining about how they're being restricted with environmental laws, should actually take a leadership role. They are the individuals that can turn on a dime. They are the individuals, groups of people who have lots of resources. We should be viewing capitalism as something which will make the entire planet better. So corporations really should be stepping up and saying, we are going to take charge. We're not going to wait for the Environmental Protection Agency to dump on us some new regulation. We're going to go out and find solutions ourselves.
So do you think businesses are taking that message, taking that advice, and in fact becoming more proactive and less reactive on this front?
I think they're taking baby steps. A giant corporation like Toshiba, they've decided without any reason for their operations to protect two endangered tiny little fish by building their own in-corporation breeding program. L'Oreal in France was accused of destroying this purple orchid for their cosmetics. So they bought acres of greenhouses, and now that purple orchid is tidally off the endangered plant species list. So these are baby steps. Corporations the size of Microsoft need to step it up 100-fold. There's no reason why they can't. They should realize that if you're going to be in a capitalist society, then maybe capitalists should be making decisions and not leaving big decisions to all the bureaucrats.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. I'm Tom Lujack. Joining us in the studio is Tim Haas, Associate Professor of Business Statistics in the Lubar School of Business. And as we've heard in the first part of the program, someone who's using those skills with statistics and algorithms and a lot of other things I couldn't even hope to begin to do to help protect the diversity of plant and animal life here on the planet. Tim, as you talk about the opportunity for these businesses to embrace this notion of biodiversity, of saving the planet, if you will, what else is in it besides the fact that they don't get the shareholders angry at them and can stay on their good side? Are there clear demonstrated results of having a more diverse planet from a business standpoint?
Well, you go down a slippery path there. There's a tremendous amount of research coming out right now on something called ecosystem services. And the idea is that the ecosystem is providing essential things to humankind, and that because there's no market, we have been skating by with not paying the bill, so to speak. And so therefore, all sorts of things that our world provides us, we should be paying for. Well, this is a complicated window dressing for the word tax. I think that the day has come where humans have to decide what sort of planet they want and view it as a luxury item, the entire planet. We can get along quite well if we kill off all the rhinoceroses. Obviously, we don't need rhinoceroses. We don't need cheetah. We don't need great white sharks. You can make some argument that sort of that they're the top of the food chain, but it would be easy to get by for hundreds and hundreds of years without any of these animals. The same goes for really clean water and really clean air. There's 7 billion of us now on the planet. So whatever problems we have with pollution, obviously they're not threatening our birth rate at all. So if you think about it, corporations need to say to themselves, look, we are in a leadership position. Let's stop making excuses and decide what sort of planet we want for ourselves and our great-great-great-great-grandkids.
Because at the end of the day, it's good business. Because if the environment is healthy, that means there's a better place for those customers to live and to consume products.
Yes. But you can't really, in my opinion, having been in the business school a number of years, I don't think you can make a hard and fast economic argument. You have to view it as a decision that you make about the quality of your life and everyone else on the planet. Anything else is simply just a complicated sophistry that people will see through very quickly. If everyone on the planet got together and had a big meeting and decided, what do we want to see the planet be like in the next 100 years? And everybody ironed it out, kind of like a Vatican II for the Catholic Church. Then we would say, okay, how are we going to get there? Well, we basically have to do that. We'll either do it explicitly or we'll do it by our behavior. Right now, by our behavior, we're killing off many, many, many species. So by our behavior, we're saying that biodiversity is not very important. I'm not sure that everyone would agree with that statement, but that's the decision we've made implicitly at the moment.
And if you're a tribe member living next to that national preserve in Africa, where that rhinoceros is, the notion of doing something right for the planet, you know, is overshadowed sometimes by, I need to get food on the table for my family of 8 or 9.
That's exactly where I was when I earned tenure in 1995. I said, okay, there are local decisions and there are global ones. And right now, the collection of local decisions is implicitly becoming the global decision. But to do any real world modeling, you must model the poor Mozambique 21-year-old male who's been offered $200 to risk his life to go out and shoot a rhino and hack off its horn. You must understand that person, because you cannot scale up to the planet until you understand why that individual is willing to kill an animal for which the population dynamics models say, if you keep doing this, they'll all be gone in 6 years. Well, folks that have millions of dollars to their very own name, I would argue, are in a position where they can actually stop and think about this problem themselves. And they're in the position to do something about it, the Mount Mozambican individual.
So rather than lamenting, let's take, for example, a movie star, and movie stars, I think, love social causes and ecological causes. Instead of going around and doing a benefit concert or using their celebrity status to draw attention to the problem, you're suggesting maybe pull out their own wallet and put their money where their mouth is.
If you want to make Africa really angry, publish a paper like that was published in Nature in 2005, where the author says, let's buy a couple of million acres in New Mexico. Well, Bill Gates has that money. And then let's fly over there to this area we've bought and wrapped a big fence around, giraffes, hippos, rhinoceroses, lions, and stick them there until the unstable and very poor countries in Africa get their act together. Africa exploded in anger when this article came out. But the guy had a point. He said, look, corporate America has more than enough money to buy this land. What is stopping them from doing this? That's my essential example of what corporations really could be doing if they wanted to.
Right, right. But as you point out, there's a whole social backlash that would create another set of issues for the people who are currently living next to those giraffe and those rhinos.
Well, you don't have to take them all. You could leave a few.
So, Tim, talk about your students. The young people who are 18, 19, 22 years old, when they hear this argument, how do they respond? Do they see perhaps a role for them and their career to help save the diversity of the planet?
The undergraduates at UWM that I have taught, and I've taught thousands of them, they are thirsty for someone to tell them in real terms what the problems actually are and what possible solutions there are. They are so sick of being fed politically correct pablum that they can see through in 22 seconds that when someone speaks to them about how the world really works and what could be done, they are all over it. Unfortunately, they don't see a direct connection in their life. That it's been my experience. The undergraduates that I've met in the business school are heavily in debt. They're working three jobs. They're trying to get their business degree so that they can have a normal life. But they are very concerned about the world, and they see it going in rather bad ways. But there is a sense of hopelessness among a lot of young people that the problems are just too complicated, and I am too small, and I have enough problems to where I can't do anything about it.
But they have to be impressed when they see you go ahead and scrape and scrounge and find the money to get a plane ticket and go ahead and do this statistical modeling in Africa.
Yes, I see that. I see them thinking, gee, maybe it is possible to do something.
Have you talked to any Wisconsin-based businesses about your philosophy of this deeper commitment to protecting biodiversity?
Not so far.
Okay, so that might be on your list.
That's a good thing to put right at the top of my list, yes.
Well, and that's why we're doing this program. Who knows who might be listening, right?
Good plan.
And see potential.
Yes, I would welcome such conversations. I have just been so overloaded with just trying to keep my head above water work-wise that I have not been networking like I should.
Yeah, yeah. Tim, just a couple of minutes left. Where do you see your work going in the future? Are you going to continue to work in those environments like Africa, looking specifically at some of these terrible threats to the wildlife that, you know, we might not see down the road?
Yes, I thought back in 1995 that the biggest problem we face is biodiversity loss in countries that are extremely poor. And so I will continue to work in areas, for example, the cheetah in Kenya. But what I plan to do is you alluded to just a minute ago, is I'm trying to figure out ways to get developed countries in the loop, because the money is all in the developed countries. So a way to get them to find ways that they can use their money to actually help stem the loss of biodiversity in very poor countries. That is my grand challenge.
Although if anybody needs a lesson closer to home, we have our own challenges just here in the Midwest protecting some wildlife.
But see, North America killed off all of their important species years and years and years ago. And unfortunately, it's too late for North America. But it's not too late for equatorial nations mainly.
So and we are talking again about those South American or African nations that have yet to see the clear cutting of forest across the continent.
Yes, exactly.
Well, Tim, it's fascinating conversation. I never made that link between how statistics and mathematics could be so closely tied to saving some of the species that we so treasure on our planet, and I really appreciate your insights.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tim Haas, Associate Professor of Business Statistics at the Lubar School of Business, our guest today talking about sustainability and biodiversity on our planet. That's all for this week's program, folks. I'm Tom Lujack. We'll see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody.
You've been listening to UWM Today, the weekly program where you meet the faculty, staff, and students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, who help make a difference in the lives of people in southeastern Wisconsin through their teaching, research, and community service. To learn more about UWM, go online to uwm.edu.